Welcome to the Evaluating Biopharma podcast, where we meet with the top experts in the field to deconstruct challenges and opportunities that they've each experienced in order to provide you, the listener, with real-world practical advice and knowledge to help you in your own work and see things just a little bit differently. I'm your host, Ben Lockwin, and it's my pleasure to sit down for a chat again with my friend and colleague, Stefan Schmidt, CEO of Evitria. Hello, Stefan. Great to have you here again.
Hi, Ben. Thanks. Thank you for the opportunity and great to speak again with you. It's always enjoyable to have a chat around really interesting scientific topics.
Agreed. Welcome back, my friend. You recently had a poster presentation at Pep Talk, I believe, on the topic of enhancing a technique for polishing bispecific antibodies using ion exchange chromatography. Is that correct?
Absolutely, that's true. So we had quite a nice advancement in our ability to purify and to produce, of course, bispecific antibodies, which was a nice achievement. I had quite a lot of questions around this. And then the poster session, it was a nice reaction of the audience, actually.
Yeah, I've read the poster. It's quite excellent. There's even a section in there about some in silico optimization in your work that the team took on.
Right. So I think we have prepared some kind of in silico approach to predict how a bispecific antibody would behave under purification conditions and how you could optimize this. So in the end, streamlining the process, saving time, and become more predictable and more reliable.
Yeah. Well, today I wanted to catch up with you and discuss this topic of bispecific antibodies in the industry. So as we jump into this, would you mind explaining for our audience what exactly a bispecific antibody is to get everybody on the same page?
Right, of course. I think we all know antibodies. I think we have seen the design on many posters, displays. I think it's the usual, like, Y-faced molecule that has two arms and binds the same epitope, the same antigen with each of its arms. If you think of a bispecific one, this is again having in most cases the same shape as a traditional antibody, but being able to bind with both arms individual different targets. So with one arm, you could bind to target A, with the other arm, you could bind to target B, and so have the combination of target binding in one molecule. You know, this is quite a nice feature. And despite the fact that I'm talking about antibodies, if you look at the different ways how bispecifics look like, they are very, very different. I think there are many different ways of making and doing and displaying antibodies. You
know? So from a CRO perspective, what current trend do you observe, particularly, I guess, with regard to this significant number of bispecific antibodies in discovery and development phases?
Yeah, I think the trend is quite interesting if we look back, because I think bispecific antibodies as approved products are around since like 2009. I think the first antibody was a very unconventional, interesting piece of molecule. It was the Removap, being built up from two species, actually. It was somewhat successful, but unfortunately withdrawn over time. And then was a follow-up molecule from a different company, again, trying to do something new in oncology, the so-called T-cell engagers, where actually a T-cell is kind of connected or brought into proximity and contact to a cancer cell. And by this proximity, you're killing effectively the cancer cell. And this type of molecule, the T-cell engagers, has been very successful, because if you look at the existing approved pipeline, 10 of these 14 or 13 molecules, if you take out Removap, are T-cell engagers. This is quite a lot. And if you look at the pipeline as well, it's interesting to see 10 of these molecules have been approved in the last 2 years. So it's obviously a huge wave that's coming in. And the same is true for discovery. I think it's very popular right now that many of our customers not only fulfill the single standard vanilla, I would call it, IgG antibody, they have a lot of bispecifics in the pipeline. The bispecific pipeline is really growing globally, both in Europe, but also in Asia and China. You have lots of bispecific antibodies in the pipeline. It's quite spectacular for me to see this development moving not only away, but moving towards a new format and new functionalities, which you couldn't achieve before.
Yeah, 10 approvals, I think, in the last couple of years, you said. Is that right?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so that's quite an interesting trend there. And I think proof of concept of where the industry is interested in going and where, you know, efficacy is being seen. So that's great. So maybe going into that a little bit for listeners, why even make bispecific antibodies at all? As I understand them, their general mechanism of action is different from the traditional monoclonal antibodies. And why should it even be a thing? Why do we want to make these for the industry?
Yeah, I think one obvious opportunity is you can do things that you couldn't do before with any other molecule, with any other approach. And I mentioned as example the T-cell engagers. I think this modality or this functionality didn't exist before. Yeah? So you're really kind of forcing the immune system to do something against cancer cells, which otherwise would not have been possible. Then the other nice feature is you actually have two functionalities in one molecule. So you have really simultaneously dosing of one molecule. It's on one hand also a bit better from an economical point of view, instead of two molecules potentially being able to do the same, to simply produce one molecule only. You have one way of administration only. You have one shared half-life in the body. So all of that speaks for this opportunity that you see now with bispecific antibodies. And I think if you look at the modes of action, on one hand, I explained you have the new functionality of T-cell engager. So you really have addressed the possibility to address two different cells. But of course, you could also think about what could I do on a single cell alone. I could, for instance, try to cross-link two different receptors to create a signal in the cell. But I could also try to sort of keep two receptors apart, sort of on one hand agonistic, on the other hand antagonistic effects. And I think a very nice feature of human genius is really Hemlibra. It's a very outstanding example of human creativity, where researchers have found a way to cure hemophilia instead of simply adding one of the proteases in the cascade, by simply bringing two molecules in the cascade together, and the antibody kind of catalyzes the conduction of the signal in the coagulation cascade. So this is something unseen before and really an enormous stimulation for the whole research community to see, okay, what you really could do with bispecific antibodies. So this is probably the most outstanding example I could cite here.
Yeah? Yeah, it makes me think, you know, if you can do, as you said, in a single cell, something like cross-linking two receptors having agonistic and antagonistic effects, there's a lot of different permutations, different combinations that you could go about trying to solve for. So it almost sounds like, tremendous opportunity for the future in this field.
Absolutely. I think one other example I didn't mention so far was you could also use the bispecific functionality to come over organ boundaries about, for instance, moving and transferring antibodies into the brain, because you need this efficacy in the brain. It's very hard to cross the blood-brain barrier, but you could use also a receptor-mediated transport where one arm of your antibody binds to the receptor on the blood-brain barrier, is shuttled across the blood-brain barrier, and then the other arm really exerts the activity at whatever tumor tissue or whatever neural factor is in the play. And this is also something new, what you couldn't do before. So all these kind of new avenues of treatment is the exciting thing about antibodies. It's really something new that is in the pipeline.
Yeah. Now, I hear that there's a lot of different designs of bispecifics out there. Why is that you think there are so many different designs for bispecific antibodies?
Yeah, on the one hand, it really follows the biological functionality. In some cases, you need to have a certain geometry, a certain stoichiometry, which is, can only achieve by a certain design. For instance, the T-cell engagers need a certain distance from the cancer cell to the immune cell to be really activating the response. In some cases, like Hemlibra, again, it's also critical to have the right the distance between the two molecules that in the end complete the coagulation cascade. And so on. I think the examples are numerous. In some cases, you need some flexibility in the arms that can rotate around each other, and so on, where you need linkers. In some cases, you need smaller fragments of antibodies to do the job. But overall, one part of the biological functionality has also been a bit overshadowed by IP issues, because you can imagine this is a really attractive field of business, and you try to protect your intelligence and try to protect your design. And therefore, researchers were forced to find ways of kind of circumventing the blockade of IP, also be more creative and find new solutions. I think also this shows some evolution of understanding what you have to do to make the molecule better. Because in the beginning, it was really difficult to create bispecifics, and now it's pretty much a standard job. However, there's still designs being popping up every year with new ideas. But nevertheless, I think the huge wave probably we have seen, and it's a kind of stepwise evolution on one hand, but also stepwise kind of evasion of IP blockade. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. So as far as conjuring these into being, you know, the hard work of producing bispecific antibodies, what do you see as the biggest manufacturing issue here?
I think you probably can drill down into two avenues here. One is certainly the upstream part, where you need to find a way to produce enough quantities of the molecule. And then again, a very specific issue around the DSP, the downstream part, is how to get rid of all the potential impurities, because impurities now not only come from the cell and your process, but they now also come from the design, meaning you have really unproportional load of product-related impurities that you need to get specifically rid of and which are difficult to get rid of. Yeah? But let's focus first on the upstream part, yeah? Because if we look at the design, and particularly if you have a asymmetric design where you have heterodimers, meaning one arm is certainly totally different from the other, and you have kind of not a symmetry in the molecule itself, mm-hmm. you have at least to generate four different peptide chains that have to be formed in a proper stoichiometry, need to find each other in the cellular process, being secreted together, and not fall apart afterwards. So this is quite challenging because I think as soon as you have one type of molecule, not enough of it, not enough amount of it, you have incomplete antibodies. Or if you have more of one species around, then you have kind of a high increase of your impurity, which is not properly formed. So I think here people have really tried to sort of play around with plasmid ratios, generating the cell line with different transposon technologies and so on. So already the first step of creating a stable cell line that produces reliably a high concentration of your desired product is quite challenging. And you can right now only do this by empirical approaches, really screening a lot of different cell lines to find the one that's probably best suited. So this is the upstream part. Yeah. Let's now assume you have found one of these cell lines producing it in a decent amount. And decent amount is already a bit lower than the standard antibody you would see. I think standard antibodies currently achieve 5 grams and more. And this is already a bit challenging for some bispecific formats. But then comes the downstream part, where you really have to get rid of all the impurities. And you can imagine, let's take a simple case where you have four polypeptide chains that have come together. In the end, you write heterodimer, for instance, yeah? And all the impurities, they have the unfortunate tendency to be pretty similar to your desired product. So the differences are pretty minor, and you need to be very sophisticated in finding out conditions where you can separate them off. One part you can already do is the classical protein A chromatography, where you not only do a step elution and say, okay, everything that comes off with a low pH is my right molecule. This is unfortunately not true. The alternative to that would be to run a pH gradient to start with a slightly higher than usual pH and go down to the typical low pH. And you see some elution patterns coming off in this gradient where incomplete antibodies potentially elute earlier than the real complete one. So you can already have some separation on the protein A part. The more sophisticated method then is ion exchange, because you can assume that all these polypeptide chains have potentially different PIs and can be charge separated from each other. So this is the next step, usually done for polishing, that you use your kind of incomplete and still, let's say, contaminated with impurities pool from the protein A. And then you apply ion exchange, and they can then separate out really very minor charge differences. And I think there are papers around that have shown that you can even differentiate one charged amino acid from each other, which is actually what you need in that cases. And then the last kind of difficulty could be, because you have now sometimes a bit unnatural constructs, that these constructs tend to aggregate because they have some hydrophobic patches which are at places where they shouldn't be, and you have some aggregation because of that. You might need a hydrophobic interaction as well at the final polishing step to get rid of all these aggregates. So overall, you potentially have to deal with the same number of steps in the downstream, but to implement the steps in the best possible way, it might be a bit more complicated than you're used to with classical antibody. Yeah.
Mm, yeah. So on the point of going back to what you had said earlier, it's still kind of sticking in my head, but combining it with what you just discussed. So on the notion of intellectual property and combining it with manufacturability issues, maybe, it seems to me that going after IP immunity by having a lot of degrees of freedom in the design makes it like the Wild West, you know, more of a business-centric decision and not necessarily a scientific or patient-centric decision. Do you see that kind of chaos stabilizing in the near future with respect to standardizing or consistency and approach of producing these?
Yeah, you're certainly right with your analysis. In theory, if you look in literature, you find probably up to 100 different designs of bispecific antibodies. And in reality, some work better than the others, partly because they have built-in features that allow a higher proportion of the proper heterodimer to be formed. This is one of the certain advantages you will see, and this is also the designs that are more successful in the clinic and also during manufacturing. And the other point is certainly, okay, what variability do I really need? And if you look at the like 13 currently approved antibodies, you see already some interesting pattern, because some of them, and I think they're still a bit fragmented, the distribution of different formats, but three of these 13 antibodies are duobodies, which means on one hand, you could either produce the two antibody functionalities separate and mix them afterwards together to sort of create this heterodimer artificially afterwards by simply using mild reducing agents. Or the other quite successful formats are knob into hole formats, where one of the arms has kind of an extrusion of a bulky amino acid, where the other creates kind of a hole with a smaller antibody, with a smaller amino acid, and they kind of click together like a Lego system. This is also relatively popular in the meantime. And then you see also some cross-map functions, which is a design made by Genentech Roche, where you drive the building of the proper association of light chains to the heavy chains by kind of swapping domains around. So I think these three concepts, knob into hole, duo body, and cross map, this is just a two and two setup where you have two times the same format on both ends. You probably have a classical antibody with the same epitope binding on one end, and you have like an addition of scFvs at the C-terminus instead, so you can have this mixture of kind of orienting them at from the top to the bottom, for instance, not from left to right, but from the top to the bottom as a design, for instance. Yeah? So overall, of these 100 different designs, you probably see less than 10 being more frequently used than the others.
Now, that's very interesting. Okay. Wow. Yeah, that's a lot to think about there. So you've covered a lot. And looking ahead, what do you see as the future for bispecific antibodies? You know, whether that's a year, 2 years, 3 years out, or even beyond?
I believe we will see, and we already see this to some part, a bit more of platform technology formation. I think platform with a classical antibody is really protein A plus a one-step purification or polishing at the end. Higher titers, of course, and probably also more insight from a manufacturability point of view, What kind of mutations and what interactions you should omit, because that has a negative effect in your output in the end. So the body of knowledge how to deal with antibodies will certainly increase and will lead to a more platform approach. We will also see some, I believe, a consolidation of formats. I think all these 100 different formats will certainly go down to the probably handful or 10 different formats which are more successful based on biological function, but also manufacturability. And then I think we will see still a lot of human creativity. I think we will probably see some more interesting applications of bispecific antibodies. And what I've seen just recently are examples where you use bispecific antibodies in the context of ADCs, antibody drug conjugates. And here the challenge is to bring your toxic payload into the cell. And some of the interesting targets that you have in cancer, and ADC is primarily a cancer, anti-cancer application, are not necessarily internalizing. So what you do with bispecifics instead is to have one arm with a weaker binding affinity to one of the obligating internalizing receptors, which are present on many cells, but then to sort of complement the effectivity of binding to have a high affinity binder towards cancer-typic epitope, which is not necessarily internalizing. This means by the combination of these two affinities, your payload is driven into the cell and you can address new targets that were unaddressable by ADCs so far. So I think you will see certainly some more creativity, but of course, on the other hand, you will see some more stabilization on the format front and on the production front. So this will be quite interesting to see what new ideas of mode of action are popping up and how much is it applied. It will be really exciting, both for us as scientists, but also from a patient perspective. There will be more opportunities for cures around, better opportunities, more targeted opportunities. And I think it's benefiting society overall. But of course, me as a scientist, I'm also curious, and I love to see the curiosity being fulfilled by the new designs of my colleagues around in the scientific community.
I think that's a perfect place to end it. That's about all of our time for today, but really great to spend time chatting with you today, Stefan. Thanks so much for your time and sharing your expertise. It was fantastic to hear from you and chat again. Always insightful. And if people want to connect with you and your team for more information, where can they go?
They can find me, of course, on LinkedIn, but I think the best place to look is Evitria. Evitria.com. We have a nice webpage, and I think we're also present at many conferences. You can easily catch up with us on conferences and discuss your specific needs, because I say always as a CRO or CDMO, you see the pipeline of the world, and we see really a lot of these designs, what I've spoken about, in reality. And this is exciting also to talk to the people who make them, and challenging ideas to solve issues together. I think this is to do and what we are good at. And I think look forward to interactions popping up after our chat. Thanks again, Ben, for this nice opportunity to speak and share some insights, and also getting really good questions from you. Thanks, Ben.
Good. I appreciate it. Thank you again.
We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Please visit www.evaluatingbiopharma.com to access the on-demand video and to download the summary article. You can also access the Evaluating Biopharma content archive, sign up for our newsletter, and register to attend an upcoming Evaluating Biopharma virtual networking event. Feedback or suggestions? We'd love to hear from you.